Okay, we're beginning here on the top of Chaf Dalet Amud Aleph, 11 lines down. The Gemara says, Gufa, quotes from something that we saw yesterday, in terms of explaining the position of Rabbi Meir in the Mishnah. We want to understand why Rabbi Meir believes that the litigants can disqualify Edim. How is it possible that the litigants can just willy-nilly disqualify the Edim? And we saw four different approaches to that yesterday. The first of which was brought by Reish Lakish, who said that the explanation of Rabbi Meir's position is that it's a case where he accepted an aid kibet rei. He accepted an aid to be as if it was worth two, or as if he was a set of edim, and therefore would qualify to extract money from him, whereas if he had just come in a normal circumstance, this aid would not have power. So the litigant empowered the aid, and the question is, can you retract that empowerment, or can you not retract that empowerment? That's the way that Reish Lakish explained that machloket between Rabbi Meir and the Chachamim has the ability to disqualify the Edim. After that, we saw three other answers. We saw Rabbi Elazar, who said that it's a case where you're disqualifying the Eid indirectly through a Pagam Mishpacha. And then we saw the two quotes in the name of Rabbi Yochanan, first of all from Rabbi Dimi, who suggested that it's a case where he says that he's going to bring two sets of Edim. And the question is, can the litigant in another Eid disqualify the first Eid? And that's dependent on the machloket about Tzarich Levarer. Do you have to uphold your claims of evidence? And then we saw again from Ravin, Amar Rabbi Yochanan, the question about Amigo, where do we say since he was validated with regards to the sustainment to disqualify one party, the Edim, does that affect the Dayanim, and vice versa? So those were the four answers we saw yesterday. Here the Gemara is going back to that answer of Reish Lakish to investigate further. Gufa, Amar Reish Lakish, Pekadosh, Yemar Dover Zeh? How could it be this holy mouth would say such a thing? Meaning that he's referencing to Rabbi Meir's statement that you're allowed to disqualify an eid. So it says in the Mishnah, Edav, that he's allowed to disqualify a set of Edim. We know that the Torah empowers Edim to be believed. Meaning that if two Edim come, they're given Nemanut, according to the court, unless we can find some reason to undermine them. That's with another set of Edim, or Edim Zomimim, or through some outside source that disqualifies these Edim. But the litigant himself has no right to undermine the statement of the Edim. And so how could Rabbi Meir have this position that you could undermine Edav? So Tnei Edo. So the way that we solved that problem was to make it into the singular instead of the plural, and say it's talking about one Eid. Ini, V'amar Ula Ro'et Reish Lakish Bebeit Midrash Kilo Oker Harim Tochanan Zeh Bazeh. How could Reish Lakish be saying this about Rabbi Meir? He's giving him these accolades, and speaking about Rabbi Meir, Pek Kadosh, like this unbelievable Talmud Chacham. Meantime, Reish Lakish is unusually erudite, and he was a tremendous mepalpel. He was able to take mountains and crush them together, in that he was a tremendous force in the Beit Midrash, and his ability to think through things, explain things, reconcile things, was vastly ahead of many of his peers. So why was it that Reish Lakish was, in a sense, complimenting Rabbi Meir in that manner? Amar Ravina, that's not a problem. Hello, Kolare, Rabbi Meir, Beit Midrash, Kilo Ker, Hare Harim, Tochanan Zeh Bazeh. Rabbi Meir was even on a higher level than Reish Lakish, because anybody who saw Rabbi Meir learning in the Beit Midrash could see him uprooting mountains on top of mountains and then crushing them together. So despite the tremendous gift and talent that Reish Lakish had, Rabbi Meir said even above that of Reish Lakish, and that's why Reish Lakish complimented Rabbi Meir, or said, how could it be that a Pek Kadosh could see such a thing? V'hachi kamar. And from that, he would conclude, Bo re'eh, kamar mechabibim zed zed. See how much the Talmidei Chachamim in Eretz Yisrael love each other, that they come to the defense of one another, and that Reish Lakish, with his tremendous understanding, erudition, his depth of understanding, still was willing to back Rabbi Meir. Now, from the Gemara, it sounds like he's backing Rabbi Meir, because Rabbi Meir is even on a higher level than him. So there are some questions that surround the Gemara over here. I'll just highlight a couple of them, the first of which is, didn't Reish Lakish owe Rabbi Meir a certain amount of kavod just because we're dealing with an Amora Reish Lakish and a Tana Rabbi Meir? So why is the Gemara surprised by the fact that Reish Lakish addresses Rabbi Meir in such a manner? The second thing you have to understand is the Gemara answered in the end what seemingly is that Reish Lakish gave kavod to Rabbi Meir because Rabbi Meir was on an even higher level than Reish Lakish. And so it wasn't surprising, despite Reish Lakish's tremendous talents, that Rabbi Meir was even greater than him, and that's why he complimented him. But that's not what the Gemara concludes. The Gemara concludes, Kamim Mechavimim Zeh Zeh. see how much they love each other. So you have to either read the Gemara slightly differently or understand it a little differently. First of the questions that we asked before was, isn't there an automatic deference that has to be given between an Amora and a Tana? The answer is yes, that is true. But the accolade, the appellation that Reish Lakish gives to Rabbi Meir is significant. He says, Pe kadosh ima davar zeh. That's something beyond what is necessary in terms of kavod from an Amora to a Tana. And therefore the Gemara is piqued by the fact that he used such a terminology that there must be something behind that. And then the Gemara is perplexed by why would Reish Lakish give such a compliment to Rabbi Meir if Reish Lakish was this tremendous mind? And the answer, according to Ravina, it seems, is that Rabbi Meir was an even greater mind than him. And then the Gemara concludes, Boreh kama mechavim zeh zeh. See how much they love each other. And that Reish Lakish, despite his tremendous understanding and his abilities, he went to the defense of Rabbi Meir. Rather than being undermining Rabbi Meir, he went and defended the position of Rabbi Meir. So that's one possible way to read it. The also other possible way to read it seems to be what the Rabbeinu Hananel is suggesting over here. If you look in the Rabbeinu Hananel, in the second wide line of the Rabbeinu Hananel, he says, Va'afal pi sha'amai Ravina. Rather than Ravina's statement being an answer, according to Rabbeinu Hananel, it's a part of the question. He says that even though Ravina said that whoever sees Rabbi Meir, Bebeit Midrash, nevertheless, Reish Lakish still complimented him. And that means that according to Rabbeinu Hananel, the question ends at the point after Ravina's statement, and Ravina's statement is not an answer. Until now, we've been reading the question about how Reish Lakish said this, and the answer was Ravina. But the way that Rabbeinu Hananel is reading it is that Ravina is a part of the question. And he says, Afal Pisha my Ravina. And what he's pointing out is that someone with that type of skill set, that tremendous understanding ability, sometimes makes big mistakes, which is that you can, with that intuition, that depth of understanding, that tremendous mind, you can do amazing things. But sometimes it leads you a little astray, or leads you down a path that doesn't lead to the proper outcome or understanding. And that we see, actually, the Gemara in other places speaks about the fact that Rabbi Meir's Chaverim could not understand him. They couldn't get to the depth of his understanding. They couldn't really grasp his explanations. And therefore, the Gemara says that many times the Halacha can't be like Rabbi Meir because the Chaverim couldn't get to understanding in order to question or to challenge his positions. And Reish Lakish, who was on a similar plane as Rabbi Meir, understood that. So Reish Lakish had two choices now. He understood the personality of Rabbi Meir. He was a similar type of persona to Rabbi Meir. He could either say Rabbi Meir's wrong, because look, when I do this sometimes, I realize I make mistakes, or that this type of learning leads to those types of errors, and maybe that's one of the answer could be over here. Instead, Reish Lakish goes to the defense of Rabbi Meir rather than saying that. And even though Ravina says that Rabbi Meir was similar to Reish Lakish, nevertheless, Reish Lakish does not dismiss Rabbi Meir, but rather defends him. And that's what the Gemara says in the conclusion. See how much the Talmidei Chachamim and Eretz Yisrael love each other. Because Reish Lakish, instead of dismissing Rabbi Meir, defends Rabbi Meir. And that's the answer to the question that ends with the whole statement, including Ravina, according to the Rabbeinu Hananel. So those are the two approaches to reading this Gemara and make it more understandable. And the Gemara now brings additional proof to the fact that the Talmidei Chachamim in Eretz Yisrael were kind to each other or good to each other. Rabbi was sitting and saying over, Asur lahatmin et tzonein. One is not permitted to cover up or bury something that is cold on Shabbat. We know that when it comes to hot items on Shabbat, one is not allowed to be matmin on Shabbat. And there, their restriction has to do with problems of bishul and shema yechate b'chalim. We worry about things that are what are called mosiv hevel, things that add heat, as well as things that maybe don't add heat. Maybe we worry about that because of things that add heat. But that's got to do with items that are hot, and you're either trying to maintain that heat or increase that heat through hatmanai that you are burying or that you're uncovering entirely. There's also a usage for the same type of hatmanai in the reverse, which is to keep something cool rather than to keep something hot or warm. Rabbi Seir connects between the two and says, just like it's problematic to do this on the heating side, it's also problematic to do this on the cooling side, to maintain the coolness of an item that you submerge, that is also problematic. Amar lefanav Rabbi Shmuel b'Rabbi Yosi. So Rishon, Rabbi Yossi is learning in front of Rabbi, says, Abba hetir latmina tetzonein. My father, referencing to Rabbi Yossi, was matir. He said it's totally mutar to put sonein into the ground and cover it up in order to maintain its coldness, which is the way that we pass in halacha. So Amalei, so Rabbi says back to Mishmuel Rabbi Yossi, Kvar horez zakein. Your father said that, I will accept it, and we will follow that position of your father. So Amar Papa Bore Kamechavim Zedzeh. Once again, see the tremendous kavod and respect that was given between the Talmidei Chachamim and Eretz Yisrael. Deil Rabbi Yossi Kayam, when Rabbi Yossi was alive, Haya Kafuf Yoshev Lifnei Rabbi. He was sitting like a Talmid in front of Rabbi. Daha, how do I know this? The Rabbi Shmuel Rabbi Yossi Memalei Makom Avotav Haba. Rabbi Shmuel Rabbi Yossi filled his father's shoes. He filled in the position of his father. He might even have been on a greater level than his father. Vehaya, despite that, Kafuf Yoshev Lifnei Rabbi. And we see from this story, he was sitting in front of Rabbi, learning like a Talmid in front of Rabbi. So then, the same thing is true of his father, Rabbi Yossi. Nevertheless, the Kamar, Vahore Zakein. Nevertheless, Rabbi says, if Rabbi Yossi said it, I accept it. So even though Rabbi Yossi was a Talmid in front of Rabbi, and even though Rabbi Shmuel Rabbi Yossi was a Talmid in front of Rabbi, when he heard what Rabbi Yossi had said, he gave tremendous respect and weight to that statement of Rabbi Yossi, and he paskin like Rabbi Yossi. Now the question of why Rabbi was greater than Rabbi Yossi is interesting. It either could be because of Nesiut, because Rabbi was a Nasi, and therefore Rabbi Yossi was kafuf to him. Or it could be that at certain point in time, Rabbi Yossi was greater than Rabbi. Rabbi was younger than Rabbi Yossi, but eventually Rabbi grew to the point where he exceeded his one of his rebbeim, Rabbi Yossi, and became even greater than him, and that's where the tables turned. And Rabbi was then the Rebbe, and Rabbi Yossi was like the Talmid Yoshev Lifnei Rabbo. So for either one of those possibilities, Rabbi Yossi was kafuf to Rabbi. And despite that fact, when Rabbi Shmuel Rabbi Yossi quotes his father, Rabbi is respectful and accepts that statement and says halacha is like what Rabbi Yossi said. Amar Rabbi Yoshaya, my dichtiv, what is meant in the pasuk in Zechariah when he says, Vekech li shnei makalot, I took two staves, achad karati no'am, one of them I call gentle, peaceful, nice, achad karati chuvlin. And the other one I called a destroyer, or the way that Rashi describes over here, something that is as, something that's strong, ve-chema, it has anger associated with it. Noam, things that are pleasant, elu tamidei chachamim she-Eretz Yisrael. These are the scholars in Eretz Yisrael. Shemanimim ze leze behalacha, because they are gentle and good to each other in halacha. Chovlin, elu tamidei chachamim she-Bavel. Chovlim describes the Talmidei Chachamim Bavel, Shemechablim Zed Zeb, Zed Lezeb Alacha, that they destroy each other, they beat each other up over the Halacha, and that's what Rashi says here. They're shown Az V'Chema, Makshim Zed Lezeb, they do it with strength and anger, they question each other. Bnei Yisrael Nochim Yachad, they're nice to each other, pleasant to each other, Umayinin Yachad, and they look into the matters together. They fix each other, they help each other out, and therefore you end up with a better outcome. Because they work in tandem, they work together, rather than in a adversarial manner that is found in Bavel. So the halacha, or the learning in Bavel, is more adversarial, whereby there's questioning, there's pushing, fighting, back and forth, in order to get to the conclusion, whereas in Eretz Yisrael, it's done more along the lines of collaboration. And so therefore, the two maklot over here represent those two types of Talmidei Chachamim. And what's interesting about them is that the language of Noam versus Chovlim, that the language of Noam is in singular, and the language of Chovlim is in plural, which is that Noam and that pleasantness derives from a certain amount of achdut, of unity between the Talmidei Chachamim and Eretz Yisrael. Whereas the Chovlim, which is the adversarial relationship of the Talmidei Chachamim, derives from the plurality, which is that there is a diversity or a lack of unity in the Talmidei Chachamim in Bavel. And then it continues to quote from Zechariah in Perek Dalet, Vayomer Eile Shnei Bnei Yitzhar HaOmdim Ushnayim Zeitim Aleha. You might be familiar with this because we read this in the Haftorah of Chanukah, the story with the candelabra and the olives and the presses that we read from Zechariah. And it says over there, Vayomer Eile Shnei Bnei Yitzhar, these two anointed ones who stand here, Ushnayim Zeitim Aleha, and they have two olives or olive branches upon it. Yitzhar. What is the Yitzhar? Amar Rav Yitzchak, Elu Talmidei Chachamim Shebe Eretz Yisrael. This refers to the Talmidei Chachamim in Eretz Yisrael. And we have in our Gemara, Shenochim Zelazeh, but you can see in Rashni, it Shemishamnim Zelazeh, that they are oily to each other, which means Nochim Keshemen. They are pleasant, lubricated well, flow like olive oil, Be'alacha Keshemen Zayit, like olive oil. Ushnaim Zeitim, in the reference to the olive branches or the olives themselves, Alea Elu Talmidei Chachamim Shebavel. That refers to Talmidei Chachamim Bavel, Shemirim Zelazeh Be'alacha Kezayit. They are bitter to each other, like the Zayit, like the olive, whether that's talking about an unripened olive, or it's referencing to the bitterness of an olive versus the smoothness of the olive oil. But again, it's the same contrast that we saw before in the Psukim in Zechariah between the Talmidei Chachamim in Eretz Yisrael versus the Talmidei Chachamim in Bavel. And now we continue in Zechariah in Perek He. It says, Ve'esa enai ve'ere'eh. I lifted up my eyes and I saw, V'inei shtayim nashim yotzot. There are two women that were departing. V'ruach b'kanfehem. And there was wind under their wings. V'lahena knafayim. And one of them had wings, k'kanfei chasida, like that of a stork, v'tisa'ena et ha'ifa, and it lifted up the weight, ben, and the pasuk here is reversed in the Gemara, it's ben ha'aretz uven ha'shamayim, between the heavens and the earth it was suspended, v'omara la'malach ha'dover bi, so I said to the malach who was speaking to me, ana hema molichot et ha'ifa, where are they taking this weight, where are they moving this to, v'yomei lai, livnot la'bayit v'eretz shinar, it's going to build a house in Eretz Shinar in Bavel. Am Rabbi Yochanan Mishun Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, Zo Chanufa V'Gasut Aruach Sheyardu LeBavel. These two women that are mentioned in the Pasuk represent two character traits that ended up in Bavel. One of them is Chanufa, which is either translated as flattery or hypocrisy. V'Gasut Aruach is haughtiness that ended up in Bavel. And you can see that from the difference in the names that are given here, as Rashi points out, that the Kanfei Chasida Zu Chanufa, that refers to flattery or to hypocrisy, Shemar'im Atzmam Kechasidim, because they make their appearance like Chasidim, as if they are righteous individuals. And then the Ruach B'Kanfehem, and that the wind under their wings, that refers to the haughtiness, which is in Hebrew, Gasut HaRuach. So therefore, those are the two character traits that ended up in Bavel. Mar says, V'Gasut HaRuach, the Bavel Nachit? Is it really true that Gasut HaRuach ended up in Bavel? V'Amar Mar, don't we have a statement in the Gemara in Kiddushin? Asara Kavin Gasut Yadu Le'olam. There were 10 measures of haughtiness that came to the world. Tisha Natla Elam. 9 of them were taken by Elam, v'chat kol olam kulo, and the remainder was given to the rest of the world. So Elam, which we are familiar with from Shushan or Shushan HaBira, which was the capital city in the story of Purim. So Elam was a country or an empire of haughtiness, and so the Gemara in Kiddushim assigns or tells us that haughtiness of that empire was so great that it far exceeded the haughtiness of the entire world. It took 9 out of the 10 portions of haughtiness. So Gemara says, well, if that's the case, how could you argue that haughtiness went to Bavel? Gemara says, yes, in the Bavel Nochit, it started out in Bavel, but it rolled down or ended up in Elam. So it started out in Bavel, but after the ascension of Elam, it moved from Bavel to Elam. Dekanami, I can prove that to you, Dichtiv, Livnot la bayit be'eretz shinar, because it says to build herself a house in Eretz Shinar, Shmamina. So the proof here, according to Rashi, and similarly in the Rabbeinu Chananel, the proof is from the fact that it says, Livnot la, and not Livnot lahen. It says that in the singular to build a house, and not in the plural to build a house, which means that only one of them built a house in Eretz Shinar, the other one was only there temporarily, and then moved on to Elam. So that's the proof according to Rashi and Rabbeinu Chananel. On the side of the Gemara in the Masorat HaShas, you can see that he brings from the Ramban al Torah, as well as the Tosafot in Kiddushin, says the proof is from the word La, that is written without a Mapik He. That the Livnot La, without a Mapik He, means a weaker form, and that means something that is not permanent. And that's what he says here, Lo Amad La Habayit Be'er Shinar. The house that she built in Eretz Shinar did not last. And they bring 3 examples in the Torah where they have this word la that is used without a mapik hay in it and indicates weakness or indicates something that is not permanent. So since it does not have a mapike, the proof from here is the fact that it says la without a mapike shows you that the house that was built was not permanent and moved on from there. You have two opposing views as to what the proof is. One proof is that only one house was built, not two. The other proof is that one of the houses that was built was a weaker house that was going to move on or roll on to Elam. Bamamar, don't we have a statement that siman legas daruach aniyut? If you want to know where there's a lot of haughtiness, you can look for evidence of that when there's tremendous poverty. The two are associated with each other. Someone who's haughty ends up being in poverty, or in essence, it's a midah keneged midah. So a person's trying to over-present themselves to lord over other people, or act in a manner that's uncalled for, then in the end, Hashem punishes them with aniyut, with the poverty, where they won't have the ability to do any of those two, lord over others, or display their position, their wealth, and that haughtiness is then wiped out by the poverty. So Mar says, v'aniyut v'bavel nachit. When it comes to Bavel, we know there was definitely poverty in Bavel. So that would say that the haughtiness was still associated with Bavel. And so why are you saying that it moved from Bavel to Elam? It would seem like it really did stay in Bavel, or it was in Bavel. Where it says, Maniyut, when we're talking about poverty here, we're not talking about poverty in a monetary sense. We're talking about Aniyut to Torah. We're talking about poverty with regards to Torah and Torah learning. Dichtiv, because the Pasuk says in Shir HaShirim, Achot lanu ktana bishadayim ein la. We have a young sister who has yet to mature. The shadayim represent the idea of nursing or giving to others. And so they darshan from that, Amr Yochanan zo elam. That references to elam, she zachta lil mold, velo zachta lil lamed, which merited to learn Torah, but not to convey Torah, not to teach Torah. That's a reference to Daniel. Daniel was found b'shushan abirah in elam. He receives from Hashem, and he davens to Hashem, but he is not like Ezra HaSofer that came from Bavel, who's a teacher of Torah, who we saw 2 daf ago. The Gemara compares Ezra to Moshe Rabbeinu. It says that the Torah could be given by Ezra HaSofer if Moshe had not given it. So Ezra both learned Torah, but also conveyed Torah and taught Torah. So the lot of Bavel was not only to learn Torah, but to teach Torah, whereas Elam only had the lot to learn Torah, but not to teach Torah. And we know from Bavel emerged tremendous Talmidei Chachamim and many Talmidei Chachamim, including the Talmud Bavli that we're learning. Whereas from Elam, we don't have any record of any Talmidei Chachamim that emerged from that area. So therefore, the aniyut that we're speaking about here is that poverty in Torah and Torah learning. And that is associated with Elam, and that's where that Gasut HaRuach went, was to Elam. Okay, my Bavel, what's the meaning of the word Bavel? I'm Rabbi Yochanan, Blula b'mikra, Blula b'mishna, Blula b'talmud. Refers to the learning in Bavel, or the Talmud Bavli, which is mixed up and has in it Mikra, Psukim, from Tanakh, Lulav Mishnah has the quotations from Mishnayot, and Lulav Talmud, and then has the Gemara as we know it that we learn. So that would be the view of Rabbi Yochanan, and seemingly a positive view in terms of the word Bavel and the learning in Bavel. On the other hand, B'machshachim Hoshivani Kemetei Olam, just read this in Eicha, that you put me in darkness like those that are dead. Amar Rav Yirmiya, Zit Talmudos Shel Bavel. That is the learning in Bavel. So over here, Rashi comments on that. She'ein nochim zeim ze. What does it mean that they're in darkness and that their Torah is problematic? That is because they're not nice to each other. Again, this adversarial relationship between them leads that they don't end up coming to a proper conclusion or resolving, whether it's inconsistencies or doubts, because they are back and forth rather than working in collaboration. So that's the way that Rashi learns it. So Rashi seemingly sees a machloket here between Rabbi Yochanan and Rabbi Yirmiya as to the learning in Bavel, or what we think of the learning in Bavel. Rabbi Yochanan taking a positive approach or a positive view, whereas Rabbi Yirmiya seemingly taking a negative view. But if you look in the Rishonim and Achronim, you'll see that many of them try to align the positions of Rabbi Yochanan and Rabbi Yirmiya. So if you look in the Rabbeinu Chananel, he brings an alternate explanation for what it means, B'machshakim Hoshivani Hashem, Kemeitei Olam, Zet Tamud Bavel, Klomar, Ta'amim Shelo Tzvunim, Ve'alumim Kemayim Amukim. Its reasons and its depth of understanding are kept in the darkness because there's so much depth to the Talmud Bavli that it leaves many people in the dark. So in that way, the Rabbeinu Chananel sees both of these statements as being positive statements, which is that Rabbi Yirmiya is commenting on the Talmud Bavli as to the depth and greatness of the Talmud Bavli, it's so great and so deep that people can't understand it, or people have difficulty comprehending it. And Rabbi Yochanan says, well, the Talmud Bavli is shemabulbal min hakol. It's mixed up with all these different types of learning. The Rabbeinu Tam over here says, with regards to what does it mean, blula, by the Talmud Bavli, he says, v'talmud shelanu ana potrim atzmenu ma'ashamru chachamim. Our Gemara releases us from the obligation that is mentioned in Avodah Zarah. It's also mentioned in Kiddushin. Olam yishalesh adam shnotav. Person should divide up his years, technically, but as the Gemara there over says, you don't even know how long you're going to live, so you can't break up your years like this. Rather, a person's day should be broken up into thirds. Shlish b'mikra, a third learning Tanakh, shlish b'mishnah, a third learning Mishnah, v'shlish b'shas, and a third learning Talmud. The Rabbeinu Tam claims that we are yotzei, we have a dispensation, because we learn Talmud Bavli, therefore we're able to accomplish this without actually doing it, without actually learning Tanakh, Mishnah, and Talmud, just learning Talmud Bavli. We're able to accomplish that based on this memra of Rabbi Yochanan, who says that the Talmud Bavli comprised of Mikra, Mishnah, and Talmud. That's the view of the Rabbeinu Tam. Then he adds on afterwards, V'afal pikein, despite that, Anu Korim b'chol yom, every morning we accomplish this idea of learning after we make Birkat HaTorah by citing Psukim from Tanakh, citing a Mishnah, and citing Talmud or a Braita. And he says we accomplish that with Korim b'chol yom Parshat HaTamid. We reach the Parsha of the Tamid, which is Torah. V'shonim b'mishnah ezu mekuman, and we say the Mishnah ezu mekuman, because Sim Rabbi Yishmael Omer, which is a Braita from Torah Kohanim, beginning of Torah Kohanim, and that way we get Torah, Mishnah, and what they call Gemara, which is the equivalent of a Braita or something that's more explicit than a Mishnah. The same thing is true. It's interesting that the Shulchan Aruch also brings down that they do this in two cycles. We actually learn Torah, Mishnah, and then a Braita twice. We do it in Birkat HaTorah when we say the Psukim of Birkat Kohanim. Then we say the Mishnah from Peah. And then we say the Braita, which are Ela Dvarim Sh'en Lehem Shiur, and we have Ela Dvarim Sh'adam Ochol Perotem Olam Hazeh V'Keren Kayemet L'Olam Haba. One's a Mishnah, one's a Braita. So there you accomplish Torah, Mishnah, Braita. And again here, as Rabbeinu Tam mentions again, we do a similar cycle again with regards to the Korbanot. We say Parshat HaTamid, Izu Mekoman, and Rabbi Yishmael Omer. And that explains why we have that sequence, so that we get this Mikra, Mishnah, and Talmud in. Even though, as the Rabbeinu Tam says, if we're going to learn Gemara later, we're going to accomplish it anyway. Nevertheless, to associate it with Birkat HaTorah, we do all three of these items. So again, the Rabbeinu Tam views that statement of Rabbi Yochanan as being positive, and therefore, either you have to say that Rabbi Yirmiyah argues, like Rashi says, or you say that Rabbeinu Hananel, that Rabbi Yirmiyah is complimenting a Gemara Bavli. On the other hand, if you look in the star there, that the Gilyan HaShas brings to tell you to look for a Ritva in Yoma, who quotes a Tshuva Tarambam, and there he says that Rabbi Yirmi over here is L'shitato. Rabbi Yirmi L'shitato is because the Gemara in Zvachim, and Daf Samach Omid Bet, there Rabbi Yirmi makes a comment when he's speaking about individuals from Bavel. He says, Bavlai Tipshai, those foolish Babylonians, Em Tol D'yatvei Ba'arach HaShocha, they live in the land of darkness, Amrei Shmaita D'mechashcha, therefore they say over Memrot that are dark. And there you clearly see that Rabbi Yirmiyah is making a negative statement about Bavel. And we know that Rabbi Yirmiyah was Ole mi Bavel. He learned in Bavel, and then he made Aliyah and went to Eretz Yisrael, and describes the difference, the learning in Bavel versus that in Eretz Yisrael. And he found that the learning in Eretz Yisrael is much greater. We also have that from Rabbi Zeira when he made Aliyah. The Gemara in Baba Metzia on Daf Pehei Amud Aleph says that he fasted 100 fasts to forget the Torah he had learned in Bavel, in order to then learn properly in Eretz Yisrael, because Avirat Yisrael machkim. Avirat Eretz Yisrael makes a person wiser. So in that case, the way the Gilyan HaShas is pointing out, this is Rabbi Yirmiyah the Shitato, and a similar refrain we have from Rabbi Zeira, which is that the learning in Eretz Yisrael was much greater than that in Bavel. And that means that Rabbi Yirmiyah's statement over here is a negative statement. And therefore, there are others, you can see this in the Rashash, Rashash quotes the Marsha, who says something similar, and he says over here, "V'ha Adama Rabbi Yochanan," that Rabbi Yochanan says over here, that it's Blula, b'mikra, b'mishnah, b'torah, Ugamke in the Gnai. That is a negative statement. Kaperish Hamarsha Vikudushe Agadot. Like the Marsha says in the Kudushe Agadot, Kamal Kola Drashot Ilael. Like all the Drashot, to be consistent with everything we've seen here on the Daf, then the statements about Bavel weren't generally negative. The Bulala Kai Alan Sheha. That Bulala was talking about the people and not about the Gemara. Unlike what the Rabbeinu Tam says, that the Gemara is a mix of Torah, Mishnah, and Gemara. That's not what Rabbi Yochanan is referencing to. He's referencing to the individuals, that their learning was a mix, or in essence, messed up. And the Marsha quotes the Mishnah from Avot, that says that there should be a clear delineation of learning. That Ben Chamesh LeMikra, Ben Esser LeMishnah, and then afterwards Ben Chamesh Yisrael LeTalmud. So there are clear delineations. You should learn Mikra first, then Mishnah, then Talmud. The problem in Bavel was that they learned it all mixed up. They were learning things simultaneously. They were learning Talmud too early. They were skipping Mikra and Mishnah. And that leaves them Belula. That leaves them as mess. The people in Bavel, their learning is mixed up because they have a mix and match of different things. They never concentrated on particular areas to master them. And therefore, they are a jack of all trades, a master of none. And so that's what the statement of Rabbi Yochanan is. A negative statement similar to the statement of Rabbi Yirmiyah. Now the truth is that we paskin like the Talmud Bavli, and that's because we know the Rif says that the Talmud Bavli was closed after the Talmud Yushalmi, which means that the Bavli had access to the Yushalmi, and therefore we give precedence to the Bavli because it knew what was said in the Yushalmi, and then it came to its conclusions despite or knowing what was said in the Yushalmi. Now it doesn't mean they had the Yushalmi itself, but we know and we see many stories in the Gemara of Memrot that are brought from Eretz Yisrael, from Rabbi Yochanan, from Rabbi Yirmiyah, from those that were in Eretz Yisrael, were brought back to Bavel. So Bavel was well-versed or knowledgeable about the Torah of Eretz Yisrael. And for that reason, in the end, we paskin like the Talmud Bavli, which is either supportive of those positions or those views that think that Rabbi Yochanan's statement is positive towards the Talmud Bavli, or even if you believe that Rabbi Yochanan's statement is negative, there were shifts in time, which is that during certain periods, the Torah of Eretz Yisrael was ascendant, and the Talmidei Chachamim in Eretz Yisrael were ascendant, like the time of Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish, and those early periods in Eretz Yisrael, where there is strong learning of the Amoraim, and they are unfettered or not affected by the foreign rulership over there. And those same times, or periods of times in there, where the Babylonians or the Chachamim of Bavel suffered, and then later on that switches around, where the Torah of Eretz Yisrael wanes, and the center of Torah, or the Amoraim, or the erudition, is in Bavel. And so it might be that when we're speaking here in the times of Yochanan or Yirmiyah, that's the time period where Eretz Yisrael's Torah is ascendant, and where it is primary. Later on, when it comes to the closing of the Bavli, that later period, by that time, there is very little in terms of what's left in Eretz Yisrael, and Bavel has become the real center of Torah at that period of time, and that's why the Bavli takes on that added stature in terms of psak halacha. To be honest with you, there's a machloket shitot as to the approach in learning. It's true even in the time of the Gemara, meaning that Rabbi Yehuda, when Rabbi Zera wants to be Ola Eretz Yisrael, Rabbi Yehuda says he shouldn't go, that the center of Torah is in Bavel, and he says it's asur to go up to Eretz Yisrael. So even in the time of the Gemara, you have differences of opinion as to whether the learning in Eretz Yisrael is better, Rabbi Zera, versus Rabbi Yehuda, who thinks the learning is better in Bavel, and one should not leave Bavel. So that argument may have persisted till today, which is that with the reinvigoration of Torah in Eretz Yisrael, we've seen a return to that type of structured learning, which is Mikra, Mishnah, and then Talmud, and to learn in a manner that doesn't start Talmud so early or learning Be'iyun so early, whereas most of us were brought up in a manner where they learned Gemara at younger ages, and they did everything simultaneously, and truthfully, maybe even at the expense of Mikra and Mishnah, that they learned Gemara. And it's two different approaches of shitot, gishot, towards learning. And each one of them has strengths and weaknesses. Part of the strength of the one that segregates it is that you can accumulate knowledge and become experts in knowledge. The problem is that the person's mind doesn't develop as well then, and their ability to think and break down and reconcile and work through more complex issues does not develop as well, and it becomes much harder as you get older to deal with that. On the other hand, the benefits are that a child's mind isn't as well developed in these areas early on, and it's easier for them to do things where they are learning in route and repetition rather than trying to work out complexities of sugyot. So again, the truth is it probably is different for different people, and different methodologies work differently or better for different people. But the two approaches that are today found are, in essence, being argued about in the Gemara here through the Rishonim and Achronim as to whether the Talmud Bavli or the way in Bavel was better than that of Eretz Yisrael. All right, now we move on to the next Mishnah. The next Mishnah is familiar to us because we quoted it in yesterday's daf, which is Amar Lo. If one of the litigants says to his counterparty, Neman Alay Abba, Neman Alay Avicha, your father can testify in the case, my father can testify in the case. Now, the way that Rabbeinu Chananel learns it is that they will be good as edim. So he learns that the two parts of the Mishnah, Avicha and Avi, reference to using them as edim or accepting them as edim, even though they are psulim. And then, Neman Alay Shlosha Roei Bakar, I can take these three cowboys to be a beit din. That's referencing to using them as a beit din rather than as edim. So according to the Rabbeinu Chananel, you have both edim and dayanim here. People who are pasul or disqualified for those positions are being utilized either as edim or as dayanim. Others just see this all as referencing, like the Baalei Tosafot said yesterday, to dayanim because of the Shlosha Roei Bakar, that these individuals, father, your father, the Shlosha Roei Bakar being used as dayanim, and it has nothing to do with edim, although the truth is that the din would be the same by edim as it is by dayanim, that they accept upon themselves these parties to adjudicate or to testify in the case, even though they would otherwise be disqualified. Rabbi Meir Omer, Yachol Lachzor Bo. Rabbi Meir says you can retract that permission that you gave or that acquiescence to allow them to adjudicate or testify in the case. The Chamim say you can't back out. Once you've granted that permission, then it becomes binding. If he's obligated to take a shvua to his friend, Vamar Lo. And the party who's supposed to receive the shvuah says, Dorli b'chayei roshcha, take a shvuah or a neder on your head, meaning that just take a shvuah that references to yourself, not the shvuah that you would normally take in Beit Din with the Shem Hashem and with the Nikita Tchefetz and all the other trappings that come along with that shvuah, but just tell me a shvuah that on your head or a neder on your head, Rabbi Meir Omer Yacholach Zorbo, the fact that you permitted him to get away with this lighter form of shvuah and believe him, Rabbi Meir says, you can retract that. Whereas the Chachamim Omrim, Eino Yecholak Zorbo, you don't have a right to retract it. You don't have a right to back away from it. Now, as far as the Mishnah is concerned, in all likelihood, this is only true in Dinei Memononot. This can only be true in monetary matters, because otherwise you're running into what's called Matneo Masher Katuv BaTorah. You are making conditions that go against the Torah. The Torah stipulates that these people are disqualified, that these people are not ra'oi to be edim, not ra'oi to be Shoftim. So how can you override the Torah's will in these areas? So if it is non-monetary matters, then that would be a fair question. In all likelihood, when it comes to corporal, capital punishment, or other issues like that, then this would not work. The reason it works is because we're dealing with monetary matters, and either according to the one who says that Matneh Masher Katuv BaTorah B'Dinei Memonot is permitted, or we can come to any agreement between us, in that we are basically setting up, whether it's an arbitration, we are setting up a certain deal between us, and we have a right to set up any deal between us as long as we don't do anything that is explicitly against the instructions of the Torah. The Torah says if you're going to adjudicate it based on the judges that the Torah requires, these are the qualifications. But if you agree to some other method or system or arbitration, then that would work as well. And that's likely what's happening in the Mishnah or being spoken about in the Mishnah over here. But so there's a range within the Rishonim as to what the problem is with Shlosha Roei Bakar. But let us say, in general, that most of their disqualification is because of the fact that they did not learn or they're not knowledgeable enough to adjudicate properly in these situations. Amar Rav Dimi, brother of Nachman, brother of Yosef. So now we have the statement that we saw yesterday as well, which is, Kigon de Kibli Alei Bechad, when he accepted upon him one of them. So we saw this qualification yesterday. It's not a situation, it's not a case where he accepted three Roei Bakar to be the three judges in the case. But rather, he accepted one Roei Bakar to be one of the three judges. He has two kasher judges, and then the third judge is a Roei Bakar. So that's what we saw from Rav Dimi yesterday, that qualification of the Mishnah. Now, I didn't discuss it yesterday because there was too much going on in the sugya, but over here, there's clearly a machloket in the Rishonim, and actually the machloket goes even further back to the Gaonim as well, which is when Rav Dimi makes a statement over here, who is he qualifying? Is he qualifying Rabbi Meir in the Mishnah, or is he qualifying the Chachamim? So if you look in Rashi, he says, even though there are two kosher judges with him, Amar Rabbi Meir yachol lachzor bo. Rabbi Meir says he can back out of the situation. So clearly Rashi believes that Rav Dimi's statement is qualifying Rabbi Meir. Saying that even though the situation here is you have two kosher judges and one pasul judge only, nevertheless, Rabbi Meir still says, yachol lachzor bo, you can back out of it. And so Rashi sees this as being a chiddush in Rabbi Meir. Look up in the Balei Tosafot, and they say, perish a kuntres, velo nihira. We don't think that's right. Alkein nira, da amiltayu d'rabonon koi. That Rabbi Dimi is coming to qualify the position of the chachamim. The davka gon to kablu al ilave b'chad chad al riutahu. It's only in a case where he accepts them as one that that is true. The chad al riutahu, because there is only one negative. Kamrei rabona, den yachol lachzor bo. That's where the chachamim say you cannot retract your permission that you gave. If he accepted him, like we saw in yesterday's Gemara, not as a single aid, but as a double aid, or in a situation where you say that there are three judges that are all psulim, that it's not just one pasul judge and two kosher judges, but not only is there one pasul judge, all three of the judges are psulim, then you have what's called tarte l'riuta. You have two negatives here. And in that case, even the chachamim would agree that you can retract your permission that was given. So Rashi sees Rav Dimi's statement as qualifying Rabbi Meir and saying that Rabbi Meir says his statement despite the fact that there is other judges that are Ksherim here. Whereas the Balei Tosafot see it's qualifying the Chachamim's position to say only in this case do the Chachamim say you cannot retract because there's only Achad Riuto. There's only one negative thing here. Either is one Pasul Aid or one Pasul Judge. But if you increase that to two negatives, which is you say that that one Pasul Aid is worth two, which is now you're saying a Pasul Aid is an Aid, and now he's an eight, he's a double eight. So that's double negative. Or you have three judges that are all comprised of Roe Bakar. So not only do you have one Pasul judge, each one of the judges that comprise the three is problematic. So in those cases, we have Tartan Riuto, according to Balei Tosafot, the Chachamim would say you could retract it and they would agree to the position of Rabbi Meir. There's a Machloket Rashi in the Balei Tosafot, as to whom Rav Dimi is qualifying. And again, this Machloket is not just from Rashi in the Balei Tosafot, it goes back to the Gaonim's time as well, as to explain which position in the Mishnah is Rav Dimi qualifying. So now Rav Yehuda Amar Shmuel machloket v'machulach. Aval be'etein lach, divrei hakol yachol lachzor bo. Rav Yehuda here now qualifies the Mishnah machloket here between Rabbi Meir and the Chachamim, and that is, when do we say that this type of acquiescence is binding? Now there are two possible situations in which you could acquiesce that this type of psul being accepted in a case. One is a case where you are the toveya, you are the claimant, and then the defendant comes in and is trying to defend himself. And you as the claimant grant the defendant some leeway to use his father, to use your father, to use this pasul judge. So in that case, the toveya, the claimant, is going to forgive. He's going to say, you don't have to pay me anymore. On the other hand, it could be in the reverse, where you have an individual who owes money, and says to the other party, listen, I'll believe your father, my father, the Roei Bakar, if they paskin that I owe the money, I'm going to pay the money, which is a tein lecha. So what Rabbi Yehuda is trying to clarify over here is this machloket between Rabbi Meir and the Chachamim, which of those two scenarios are we speaking about? Are we speaking about a case of machol lecha, or are we speaking about a case of a tein lecha? And what Rabbi Yehuda Mashmul says is that it only works in a case of machol lecha, then that is where their machloket exists. But be'etein lecha, if it's a case where you are going to give up money, divrei hakol yachol lachzor bo, everybody agrees you can back out of it. And the reason that Rashi explains here is the difference between forgiveness versus giving money is basically amotzi mechaveru alav araya. If you are forgiving the need to pay, over there, the money resides with the other party. So when you waive your right to collect it, then the money stays where it is currently. There's no change from the cheskat kayama, that which exists already, the money stays there. On the other hand, if you say, etein lecha, that I'm going to pay you money if this comes to be true, then you're going to extract money from this individual. You're going to change the status quo based on this psak. And there he says, divrei hakol, everybody agrees, you can back away from that. That's not binding. So what he's saying is, mechila, forgiveness is binding, but a guarantee to pay or an agreement to pay in the future, that is not binding. Rabbi Yochanan Amar, etein lecha machloket. And then Rabbi Yochanan says that in a case where you are giving money, that's where the machloket is between Rabbi Meir and the Chachamim. But then, Ibailuhu, the question is, Betein lecha machloket, avabu machu lecha, divrei hakol en yachol lachzor bo. What is Rabbi Yochanan's position over here? Is he saying that the machloket exists only Beitein Lecha, but by machlokha, even Rabbi Meir would agree you can't back out of it once you've given permission for it? Odilma bein bezo machloket. Or is Rabbi Yochanan saying the machloket persists through both? Both by machlokha and Beitein Lecha, that machloket persists. So now the Gemara says, Tashma, Doma Rava. We have a statement from Rava who says, machloket Beitein Lecha. The machloket is in a case where you're actually promising or agreeing to give money based on the outcome. But when it comes to forgiveness of a requirement to pay, even Rabbi Meir will agree that you can't retract it. You can't walk away from that type of statement. Mechila is binding immediately. So if Rabbi Yochanan believes that the machloket is only by Beitein Lecha, not by machlokha, then Rova damak Rabbi Yochanan. Rova is following that position of Rabbi Yochanan. Eliyamar ben bezo machloket. If you think Rabbi Yochanan's position is in both Beitein Lecha and machlokha, Rova damak keman. Then who's Rova passing like? He's not holding like Rabbi Yehuda Mar Shmuel, and he's also not holding like Rabbi Yochanan. Mar says no problem. Rova time of the nafshei kamar. Rova has his own opinion. Rova's an amora. Rabbi Yochanan and Rabbi Yehuda are Amoraim. Rava can disagree with them. And that's exactly maybe what we have here. We have three opinions that we have the opinion of Rabbi Yehuda who says the machloket is machulukha, but by Beitein Lecha everybody agrees you can retract. You have the position of Yochanan who says it's machloket both by Beitein Lecha and machulukha. And then you have Rava's position which is the machloket is Beitein Lecha, but by machulukha even Rabbi Meir would agree you can't retract. Now, Eitave Rav Acha bar Tachlifa the Rava. So now he asks on this position of Rova, Hayah Chayav Lechaveiro Shvua, the end of our Mishnah. If he's obligated to take a Shvua, V'amarlo Dorli B'chayeiro Shvecha, that you should take a Shvua on your head, or some sort of reference to a Shvua, that you're taking a neder, or some sort of negative association with you, you're promising on your head that this would be true, and you're saying, I'll accept that type of Shvua. Rabbi Meir Omer Yachol Lachzorba. Chamim Omer Ani Yachol Lachzorba. Rabbi Meir says you can retract. Chamim say you cannot retract. And he says here, my love, what's the case over here? What we're talking about a shvuah? Aren't we talking about a shvuah deoraita, which is otan shnishbaim velo mishalmim? Shvuah midoraita is that you take a shvuah and it releases you from payment. It's the equivalent of forgiving the need to pay. And if that's the case, you see that there's still a machloket even by machulucha. I says lo. Don't read it that way. No, it references to those that have rabbinic obligations to take a shvua, or if they take a shvua, then they will collect, which are listed out in the Mishnayot and Shvuot, like a poel or a nigzal. Those people can take a shvua to collect what they're rightfully entitled to. So in that case, it'll be equivalent of etten lecha. So you can explain that part of the Mishnah as being etten lecha, and that Rabbi agrees, Rabbi Meir and the Chachamim disagree about. By malchut lecha, even Rabbi Meir would agree that you can't retract that statement. And so therefore we have to read the Mishnah that the Shvuah that we're speaking about here is Nishba'in v'notlim. So now, Baha, Tanalei Reisha. Now based on that, if you're going to say that the Shvuah in the second half of the Mishnah references to a case of etten lecha, isn't that identical to the Reisha of the Mishnah? So Gemara says no. Tana tole b'dat acherim. V'tana tole b'dat atzmo. That these two issues are different. In one case, he is relinquishing control to other parties. In the other case, he is relinquishing control to the counterparty. And you might think differently in these cases, which is, v'tzricha, you need both of them. Ditanach tole b'dat acherim, if you only gave me the case where he is relying on others, meaning that he says, nemen alai abba, avicha, or shlosha roe bakar, v'hakama Rabbi Meir dematzi hadarbe. That's where Rabbi Meir says you can retract the permission. Because he didn't, with a full heart or a full mind, really think that he was going to permit them to adjudicate the case or come to a conclusion. Meaning that he felt, yeah, maybe if they go my way, it would be great, but I don't know. And so he has a safek about granting that right to them. Who says that they're going to end up coming out on my side? And therefore, he doesn't give with a full heart permission to go that direction. That's why he can retract it. But in a case where he relinquishes control to the other party and accepts the shvua, which is basically he's relying on himself. And he's saying, listen, I believe this other guy. And when he says, I believe this other guy, and he takes the shvua, maybe that's binding enough. And Rabbi Meir would agree to the Rabbanan over there that you can't retract it because you did it with a full heart. You knew exactly what you were going to get out of it. And you know when he takes a shvuah, he's going to substantiate his claim. He's not going to take a shvuah that you're right. He's of course going to take a shvuah that he's right. And so you knew that up front. And when you granted remission to do that, you knew that's what you were going to accept. And therefore, gomar makte. And therefore, Rabbi Meir in that case might agree to the position of the Rabbanan, and you can't retract it. And that's what it comes along to tell us. Don't say that. V'yashmina b'ha, if you only told us about the case of shvuah, b'ha kamir Rabbanan, over there the Rabbanan say you can't retract it because of what we just said. B'ha'i, but in the case, and the ratio of the Mishnah, emot modi le Rabbanan, the Rabbi Meir. Maybe the Rabbanan agreed to this position of Rabbi Meir that allows you to retract it because it's tolo b'dat achirim, and maybe he didn't give Paul permission. Tzricha, that's why we need both halves of the Mishnah. To teach you that, the machlok between Rabbi Meir and the Chachamim persists in both halves of the Mishnah, and it doesn't matter whether you're tolo b'dat achirim or tolo b'dat atzmo. The Chachamim say you may not retract the permissions that you gave, and Rabbi Meir says you can retract the permissions that you gave. Right now, Amar Reish Lakish, machloket lifnei gemar din. The machloket in the Mishnah is only before they came to a conclusion. Aval achar gemar din, divrei hakol ein yochol lachzor bo. Once they come to a conclusion, he can't back out of it. He can't say, let me see which way it goes. If it goes my way, then I'll let it go. If it doesn't go my way, I'll back out of it. Rishon says that doesn't work. You can only retract permissions before they come to a conclusion. Because in that situation, you still have the safek that exists. But then you can't accept it and say it didn't go my way and then back away from it. Rabbi Yochanan Amar, the Chag Gemar Din, Machloket. Rabbi Yochanan says that even after the Gemar Din, that's there is a Machloket about between Rabbi Meir and the Chachamim as to what happens in that case. So Rabbi Yochanan says, even after the Gemar Din, you have a Machloket because there's still this problem of whether my permission was binding or not binding over here. Can it actually obligate me in this case? What did I do or what kinyan do you have that obligated me to accept whatever I said or the permissions that I gave? So ibaylo lachar gemar din machloket aval lifnei gemar din divrei hakol yachol lachzor bo. In the Rabbi Yochanan's statement again, we have the same question, which is it after the gemar din we have a machloket, but bifnei gemar din everybody would agree that you can back out of it? Odeo ben bezo machloket. Or does Rabbi Yochanan believe the machloket persists both bifnei gemar din or lachar gemar din? Tashma doma rova. The Rabbu comes and gives a psak halacha. Kibal alav karovu pasul. If he accepted a karovu pasul as an aid or as a dayan, lifnei gemar din yachol lachzor bo. Before the gemar din, before the conclusion of the case, you can back out of that permission. La'achar gemar din en yachol lachzor bo. After the gemar din, you don't have a right to retract it. Iyamart bishlamo la'achar gemar din machloket. If you believe that Rabbi Yochanan believes that only after the gemar din is there machloket. Aval lifnei gemar din divrei hakol yachol lachzor bo. But before the Gemar Din, everybody agrees you can retract, you can back out of the situation. Rovo damak Rabbi Yochanan. Then Rovo is following the position of Rabbi Yochanan. Alibid the Rabbonon, according to the Rabbonon's position. And in both cases, he's paskening like the Rabbonon, according to Rabbi Yochanan. And that means, Lachar Gemar Din, the Rabbonon say, you can't retract. That's our Mishnah. And that's why he paskens, you can't retract. With Nei Gemar Din, Rabbi Yochanan says, Divrei Hakol, you have the right to retract. So he paskens like the Rabbonon and allows you to retract with Nei Gemar Din. If you say that Rabbi Yochanan says in both instances, both if Nei Gemar Din and Achar Gemar Din, it's a machloket, Rova damar keman. Who is Rova holding like? Now the truth is, and Rashi points this out, that Rova could hold like Reish Lakish, according to Rabbi Meir. Which is that Reish Lakish in Rabbi Meir says, after Gemar Din, divrei hakol, ein yachol lachzor bo. If Nei Gemar Din, Rabbi Meir says you can, be chozer bo. So you could have been following Reish Lakish in the name of Rabbi Meir. Rashi says, even though that's true, it doesn't make sense. The lo shavik Rabbanan ba'avid ki Rabbi Meir. He wouldn't give up the position of the Rabbanan to paskin like Rabbi Meir. And so therefore, it can't be that he's holding like Reish Lakish in the name of Rabbi Meir. And also, why don't we answer the same way we answered on the first half of today's daf, which is, Rova taimid nafshei kamar. Rova has a third opinion. He's not agreeing with Reish Lakish. Nor is he agreeing with Rabbi Yochanan. He has his own independent opinion. Rashi says, Lo shayach lemeimar hocha rova tamay nafshei kamar. Because, lo ari rova beplukta klal el mifsak pasik dino. Over here, Rova's statement is different than the statement before. Rova's statement over here is giving a definitive psak halacha. So when he comes to give a psak halacha, he's not stating his opinion. He's telling you the halacha is like either Rabbi Yochanan or Reish Lakish. So it's got to fit into one of those two opinions. He's not proffering an additional opinion. Whereas on the first half of today's daf, where he spoke, he wasn't giving a psak halacha, but he was qualifying the Mishnah. And in qualifying the Mishnah, he was stating his opinion. So over there, the Gemara can say, time of the nafshin kamar. that he's saying his own opinion, and that own opinion is different than Rabbi Yochanan Shlokish. But over here, where he's giving a psak halacha, over there, you don't have the ability to say that he's giving his own opinion. It has to fit into either Rabbi Yochanan or Shlokish. So it fits into Rabbi Yochanan according to the Rabbanan, if you read Rabbi Yochanan that way, or it fits into Reish Lakish according to Rabbi Meir. And of course, we're going to favor his explanation being in aligned with Rabbi Yochanan and Libid the Rabbanan, because then it'll be La Locha. And generally, we paskin like Rabba La Locha. That's one. The Baal Tosfot adds in an additional item, which is that Rava says that everywhere that Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish argue, the Locha is like Rabbi Yochanan, chutz, where three places that the Locha is like Reish Lakish. So you see that even Rava himself says that the Locha is like Rabbi Yochanan in these situations. So once again here, he can't be saying this in the opinion of Reish Lakish according to Rabbi Meir, because he doesn't hold like Reish Lakish. He passes like Rabbi Yochanan in general, and not like Reish Lakish, with the exception of those three places, and this isn't one of those exceptions. Elav Shmina, you must come to the conclusion that Achar Gemar Din Machloket, that only after the Gemar Din there is a Machloket, but beforehand Divrei HaKol, that you can retract. Shma Mina, that is the opinion of Rabbi Yochanan, and that's who Rova was paskening like. Kesholach Le Rav Nachman, here we have an argmar Bar Rav Chista, but you can see on the Shiltot head, Bar Rav Yitzchak, Rav Nachman Bar Yaakov, Yilamdeinu Rabbeinu, please teach us, our Rebbe, Lifnei Gemar Din Machloket, or Lachar Gemar Din Machloket? Is the Machloket in our Mishnah, Lifnei Gemar Din, or Lachar Gemar Din, Valocha Kedivrei Mi? And the Locha is like whom? So Shalach Le, Lachar Gemar Din Machloket, the Machloket is Lachar Gemar Din, Valocha Kedivrei Chachamim, and the Psak is like the Chachamim. This is again similar to the position that we saw in Rava and in Rabbi Yochanan. Ravashi Amar Hoki Shalach Le. No, that wasn't the question. But the question related to what we saw earlier in the Gemara. Betein lecha machloket, o b'machol lecha machloket. Is the machloket here with a case where we're trying to extract money? Or it's a case where the person is given permission to forgive the need for payment? V'alocha k'divrei mi. And again, who the Allah is the Allah like? Shalach Lei, he sent again, similar to Rabbi Yochanan's position, and Rava, betein lecha machloket. The machloket is betein lecha, and alocha k'divrei chachamim. And the halacha is like the chachamim, again, that you're not allowed to retract in a case of be'etein lecha. The surah matniachi. That's how they learned this sugya or the gemara in surah. The pumpadita matniachi. Pumpadita, this is the way they had the sugya evolve. Amar Rabbi Chanina bar Shlamayo, shalchule mi bei Rav to Shmuel. They sent over from the Beit Midrash of Rav to Shmuel. This probably was after the passing of Rav. They sent over when Shmuel was still alive. They asked him a halacha. Lamdeinu Rabbeinu, please Shmuel, explain to us. Lifnei Gemar Din, Bikanu Miyado, Mai. If it is before the Gemar Din, but we have a Kinyan, what is the Allah over here? So again, we've already paskin that if it's Achar Gemar Din, we paskin like the Chachamim and you have no right of retraction. Lifnei Gemar Din, Divrei HaKol, you have a right of retraction. Now they add in an additional dimension, which is it's Lifnei Gemar Din, but they made a Kinyan. Shalach Lahu, to Shmuel, response to them, Ein Lachar Kinyan, Klum. Once you make a kinyan, you have no right of retraction. The kinyan makes it a binding agreement, and you can't walk away from it once you're given a kinyan, even lifnei gemar din. Now, this does relate to a situation that we saw in Baba Batra back on Daf Kuf Chav Chet Amud Aleph, where the gemar there discusses a situation in which a person grants another party the right to take a shvuah. And then the gemar says over there, shamar hashbeya batol, you take a shvuah, you can take it. His friend can take a shvuah, and he's not allowed to back away from it. So again, there, that Gemara sounds like that Lifnei Gemar Din, you don't have a right of retraction. Yet there was no kinyan that was made over there. And who is that Gemara following? So the Baalei Tosafot point out, it's actually a machloket over there between the Rashbam and the Rabbeinu Tam. And the Rabbeinu Tam says, you have to read in the Gemara over there, the Hachik Garas Rabbeinu Tam, Vinishba. It's a case where he already took the shvuah. Not that he says, Yishava, he will take the Shvuah, and you can't back out of it. Rather, Nishba, he jumped and took the Shvuah. Then, Eino Yachol Lachzorbor, Klomar, Im Kafat Zechaveiro, B'Nishba, and Yachol Lachzorbor, the came to the Kfar Nishba, Ve'Klacham Gmar Din. Once he jumps and takes the Shvuah, it's the equivalent of being Lachar Gmar Din, where he took up your permission and utilized it, and therefore you can't back out of it. That's how the Rabbeinu Tam deals with that Gemara in Baba Batra, to say that it's post the Gmar Din, and that's why you can't retract or back away from it. But absent it being after the Gemar Din, you would have a right of retraction, with the exception of a case where there's a kinyan that makes it binding. Because a kinyan gives a gmirat adat, which you can't walk away from and you can't back away from. All right, now we move on to the next Mishnah. The next Mishnah describes Eluhain Hapsulim. These are the individuals who are pasul to be Edim, and by definition, if they're pasul to be Edim, they certainly cannot be Dayanim. So the Psulim here are pasul both to be an aid and to be a Dayan. Now, the Balei Tosafot are adamant about the fact that this Mishnah is only speaking about Dinei Derabbanan. The Psulim that are mentioned here are all Midrabbanan, and it doesn't deal with issues that are De'oraita. He says there was an alternate Girsa in the Gemara that included Avadim, that included Eved Knani in the Mishnah, and Tosafot eliminates it and says it's not a good Girsa because Avadim are Psul De'oraita. Whereas all the psulim that were mentioned in our Mishnah are psulei derabanan. Now the psulim in the Mishnah are psulei derabanan that derive from gezel. The problem is that the pasuk in the Torah says, al teshev rasha eid, you're not allowed to make a rasha into an eid. And there the Gemara learns that the rasha that we're referring to over there is a rasha of chamas. So that's what the pasuk says. And chamas has to do with theft or gezel. So we know that a gazlan is disqualified from being an aid and certainly from being a dayan. And the reason being is that this is a person who does not have concern for other people's money or concern about truth and ownership with regards to money. This person's already demonstrated that either they will do things that are against the law in order to get money, they will accept bribery, they will mislead in order to end up in a situation where they get more money. And so for that reason, they're disqualified. As far as other Averot, that's a machlok between Abai and Rova that we're going to see later on in the Gemara, but here we're focused on Gezel. That Gezel is a problem De'oraita, and what we have in our Mishnah are other items that are Gezel Midrabanan, or derivatives of Gezel, and that's what makes them Psulim. So now here the Mishnah says, Ve'ilayna Psulim, the first is, Amasachek Bekubia. People who play with dice, or people who gamble. So the Mesachek Bekubia is someone who gambles. The problem here can be one of twofold. Mesachek Bekubia is, we're going to see in the Gemara in a second, might be a problem of Gezel, because Asmachta Lokanya, which we'll explain in a second in the Gemara, and therefore there's no real Kinyan over here, and it's Gezel, at least Gezel Midrabanan, and therefore this person is disqualified from being an eight. Valmalve Beribit, someone who lends money with interest. So the Balei Tosafot point out over here, Malve Beribit is an Isur D'oraita. And that's a problem D'oraita. If you tell me that this whole mission is D'rabbanan, then why are we dealing with Ribit, which is D'oraita? So the Balei Tosafot give two possible answers to that question. One is we're not dealing with Ribit Ktsutsa. It's not obvious and explicit interest. It's some sort of implicit interest or some sort of transaction, which is a Vak Ribit. And therefore, we're only speaking about interest, midrabanan. Or the other possibility is, even if it is ribit tzutza, it's ribit de'oraita, over here, people justify the collection of interest because they say the party that's paying it is doing it willingly. Gezel and chamas involve someone going and taking something from another party against their will, or stealing from them. Ribit, even though the Torah restricts it, it's not something where you are actively going and stealing from them. The other party's paying it willingly. They wanted the loan and they wanted to pay interest. You're not taking from them unwittingly or unwillingly. They're paying in willingly. And so the person is morehet there to himself that it's okay. And therefore, the gezel aspect over here is only viewed as gezel derabanan, even though ribit is an isur de'oraita. U'mafriche yonim. Again, the Gemara will give different explanations as to what mafriche yonim are. Let it suffice to say now, let's call it racing of animals. So they're betting on animals that are racing. Or someone who whistles to attract birds and is possibly stealing from birds that belong to other individuals. The Sochareh Shvi'it, and those that are transacting in Perot Shvi'it, again, the Gemara will have to deal with, why is that not a problem De'oraita, and why is it only an issue D'Rabbanan? The Balei Tosafot already hinted this, that Shvi'it V'Zman Hazeh is Midrabbanan, and therefore the problem with Perot Shvi'it, or transacting in Perot Shvi'it, is only an issue D'Rabbanan, not an issue De'oraita. So here we have all these four individuals being disqualified because of the fact that they are Gezel Derabbanan. And since it is Gezel Derabbanan, we don't believe that these people will be fair and impartial individuals. They can either be bribed in order to do something, because we see they are Chomed Mamon. They'll do things against the law in order to get money. Or that money for them is so paramount that they're willing to lie, steal, cheat. Or they don't consider ownership as being important because they're willing to steal. For all those reasons, we disqualify them as Edim, and we disqualify them as Dayanim. Amar Rabbi Shimon, Tchila Yukorin Oton Osfei Shvi'it. They used to call them in the beginning gatherers of Shvi'it. Mishrabu Anasim, once it became that there were these of thieves that were stealing away the land, Chazur Lekotam Socharei Shvi'it. Then they began to call them transactors or traffickers in Shvi'it. And again, the Gemara will describe what Rabbi Shimon is saying here, or what changed over time. But mainly the issue is that it was a small problem originally, and then it became such a prolific and prevalent problem that they called them Socharei Shvi'it in the end. I'm Rabbi Yehuda. Eimatai. When is this true? Zman she'en lehem umanut elohu. That's when they have no other profession besides this. V'yesh lehem umanut shelohu k'shirim. If they have another profession, then they are k'shirim. So Rabbi Yehuda seemingly disagrees with the Tanakhama as to the reason that these individuals are disqualified. The Tanakhama seems to think that these items inherently make a person disqualified from being an aide or from being a dayan. On the other hand, Rabbi Yehuda says it depends on how they're interacting with these items. If they have means of parnasa outside of these items, then these are only distractions or sidebars for them. Let's say with regards to Misachek Bekubia and Mafrichei Yonim, where they're gambling and racing animals, they're doing it for fun. They don't do this as their main means of livelihood. In that case, Rabbi Yehuda says they're not disqualified. It's only if this is their main means of livelihood do we consider them to be disqualified. And again, here it could be for one of two reasons. Either, the Gemara will say, is that they're animus sukim b'yishuvo shel olam. They're not engaged in productive and positive, constructive types of behavior and engagements. And so therefore, they are individuals who don't care about other people, but don't care about what happens to other people. They don't engage in what we call tikkun olam or yishuvo shel olam. And so therefore they are missing a certain sensitivity to the plight of individuals or the ownership of individuals. And that will lead them to be misguided in the way that they testify or paskin in cases, or to lie or to cheat or to steal. Or the possibility is, if this is their main livelihood, then these are types of engagements or activities that involve deception, cheating other people, and not considering the losses that are incurred by other individuals. So for either of those reasons, Rabbi Yehuda says that these individuals would be disqualified. The Gemara says, "Misachek bekubya, my kavid." He's playing dice. What is he doing wrong? What did he do that was wrong? They hear it's a game of chance. They're playing this game of chance, and he won. Why is he considered to be a gazlan in that case? So Amar Rabbi Bracham, mishum dehavi asmachta, because it's an asmachta, asmachta lo kanya. Asmachta, in a general sense, here we'll explain, is that an asmachta is where a person relies on winning. A person relies on the money being returned to him. So he makes a promise, or he invests in something, because he assumes that he's going to have a positive outcome in the situation. That means that he never really relinquishes control over his money, or never really gives a full-fledged kinyan, because he never believes he's going to lose his money. But over here, where they're betting over the dice, the question is, did he really put in his money assuming he was going to lose his money? Well, the only reason he put his money down is because he thought he was going to win the game. And if he won the game, then he would take his money back. He didn't expect to lose. Therefore, when he put the money down, he really didn't relinquish control over the money. And that's what's happening over here. He says it's an asmachta lo kanya. And since that's the case, if you take the winnings from this game of dice, you're stealing from the other party, because he never really relinquished control or gave up the money. He didn't intend for that. He never made a kinyan gamur. Anything that looks like this is not classified as an asmachta. You can see here in the Gota Gra, he thinks that the Rambam doesn't have this girsa in the Gemara, but Rashi, the Bali Tosafot, clearly do have this girsa in the Gemara, and Rashi says that this is not called an asmachta. Rashi says, I'll tell you what an asmachta is. It's not the case that you're bringing over here. What you're bringing over here, people are gomer and maknet. That's not a question. The difference is, in a case where he says, I will work as a sharecropper on this field, and if there is a year when I don't plant the field, then I'm going to pay you 1,000 zuz. I'm going to pay you a big payout because I didn't plant the field. Now, if he didn't plant the field, and he has to compensate him because the owner of the field then loses out money, that makes sense. But he makes a promise of exorbitant amount of compensation or penalty or punitive damages that he's going to pay to the owner of the field if he doesn't plant the field. That's clear that when he does that, he doesn't intend to pay that penalty because he thinks it's in his control. And that he's going to plant the field every year. So when he makes a promise like that, and then it comes around and he doesn't plant the field 1 year, the owner is not entitled to that penalty that he agreed to pay, because he never intended to pay it. That's an asmachta. That's something where he relied on his ability to plant it. There he says, "V'savur lo yaveh lidei kach." When he entered into that agreement, he believed he would never reach that point. Aval hocha lo samech amidei. Over here, he's not relying on anything. Da lo yada inatzeach ilo netzeach. He has no idea whether he will win or lose. It's a game of chance. He has zero control over it. So in that case, he doesn't believe that he's not going to lose, because he has no idea. It's a 50-50 shot. So he puts his money in, assuming that he might lose, he might win, but he puts his money in with a complete relinquishment of control. So Rashi distinguishes here between complete relinquishment, where there is no, you have no influence over the outcome in the situation. In that case, the person's gamer umaknet. He gives over the thing with a full kinyan because he knows it's not his control. Another case where he promises something, assuming that it will never become an issue, in that case, he's not gamer umaknet because he never believes it's going to come to it. He's using it, lismoch, to convince you to rely on him. He's saying that you can rely on me to plant it every year, because if I don't plant it, I'm going to pay you 1,000 zuz. He never intends to pay that 1,000 zuz. He's intending to use that to convince you that you should let him have the field because he won't leave it fallow in any year. That's the distinction that Rashi raises. The Baliyat Tosafot over here, it's a very large Tosafot, questions Rashi's distinction over here and notes that there are other times where we say that control is better than a situation where you lack control. And so then the Baliyat Tosafot come up with a different distinction, the first of which was brought by the Rabbeinu Tam, who says that it depends on the two parties that are involved. In cases where you have two parties, and only one party would suffer a loss, in that case it's called an asmachta. Like in the case of the fields, where he's a sharecropper and he says, I'm going to plant the field every year. If I don't plant them, I'll give you 1,000 zuz. In that case, when he doesn't plant the field, there's only one loser over there. That's him, because he's going to have to pay that huge penalty. It's a one-sided loss. In situations where there's a one-sided loss, that's called an asmachta. The person never intends to pay it because it's clearly a biased or unfair type of structure. On the other hand, where both parties stand to lose, in that case, they're both gamer umaknet. They both give in full-heartedly into the situation because he says, just like I could lose, so too he could lose. Or, just like I could win, he could win. And you understand that both parties can win or lose, and in that case, both are gamer umaknet because there's a fair game or fair probability between the two parties. That's how the Rabbeinu Tam explains the difference between asmachta and a lack of asmachta. That's the way that the Rabbeinu Tam explained it. The Baliyat Tosafot afterwards go on to show that there are cases where that's not true. That even where both sides stand to lose, the Gemara still seems to indicate that there's a problem with asmachta. And therefore the Re comes up with a distinction that includes what Rashi says over here. And the Re makes the following distinctions. He says there's a difference between situations in which you are fully in control, situations where you are partially in control, situations where you have no control. So now, anything that you are in fully in control, then an individual is gamer umaknet. Where you have full control over there, and you can determine the outcome, over there it's not called an asmachta. You are making a statement of your abilities and what you can do, and you believe that you're going to do it. As long as there's no exaggeration, and there's no punitive payments or damages, in that situation, we will listen to you, and we will believe you, and you will be gamer umaknet. So for instance, in a case where you are a sharecropper on a field, and you say, listen, I'm going to plant it every year. And if a year that I don't plant it, I'm going to pay you the damages for the losses that you incurred, then that is a binding agreement. Because you are paying him fair compensation for what you lost. You knew that it was in your control to plant or not plant it. You believed you were going to plant it. And you knew if you didn't plant it, you'd have to pay him the damages. That's a case where a person is gamer umaknet. That's a person enters into such a transaction full-heartedly. Other transactions where a person enters into full-heartedly is a case where you lack control completely, where you have resigned your control to chance, to luck. For instance, in the case of dice, whereby you are letting it go. You know that you have zero control over the situation. You know that it's a game of chance or a game of luck, and therefore you resign or give up control fully in that situation. And again, there's no asmachta because you're not relying on anything. There's nothing for you to rely on. You know that there are odds, And those odds are going to determine the outcome of the case. Whether the odds are 50-50, 60-40, it doesn't matter what the odds are. You know the odds that exist, and you are putting your money in, assuming those odds. Now, the Balei HaTosafot make a clarification over here. That's only true if the people put their money on the table. That means that both parties pay out before the dice are rolled. Because in that case, they've already relinquished the money. They've relinquished or given up the money or maknah the money to the table, and then the winner can take the money. But if it's done on amanah, it's done on trust, where there's like a bet or between them, and then after the dice are rolled, you'd have to pay it out. In that case, there's no obligation to pay, and there's no real giving up or kinyan that happened. So Balei HaTosafot qualify that cases or games of chance is a case where the money's already expended or out on the table. It's not just expended. Both parties have put their money on the table, and there's only a question of who's going to take it off the table at that point in time. But both parties have actually put their money in and have already resigned to the loss of that money. Their other cases are either in situations where a person has some control, but not full control over there. In that case, we will consider it to be an asmachta. Because in that case, the person relies on their capabilities or abilities to do something. So for instance, the Mordechai brings from Avi Ezri such a distinction. What happens if you are in a situation of gambling, that it's not just the rolling of a dice, which is a game of probability, but rather you're dealing with a card game, like poker or blackjack, where you think you can outsmart the other individual, where you think you can win because you're better at it. So in that case, we will consider that to be an asmachta lokanya, because that person is relying on their guile or their intuition to beat the odds in the game. And therefore, when they give in their money or they're betting on their abilities or capabilities to win the game. Now, it's not totally in their control, because the game involves chance as well. Depends what cards come up, depends what the situation is, what the other players do, the rules of the game. Meaning that there are other factors that determine it. It's not solely in your control. That is a case of asmachta, according to the Balei HaTosafot. Now, I gave you an example that the Mordechai suggests, that it's gambling as well. The Shudra Palim says that he doesn't think that's right, because the Gemara in Shabbat says about a goral, that even a lottery, where it's a complete game of chance, it says it's asur to do it because of asmachta lokanya. So you see there that the Gemara thinks that when it comes to gambling, it's a problem even when you have no control in there. And so he discards that distinction that the Mordechai makes between gambling that's complete chance versus gambling which involves a person's capabilities in order to determine the outcome of the case. The other case where the Balei HaTosafot would say it's an asmachta is gozim, where the person exaggerates. And that's the case that we spoke about before, where he says, if I don't plant the field in the year, I'm going to pay you this huge penalty. Over there, the person is clearly not intending to pay the penalty. The only reason he's setting it is, kedei lahasmich hadat. He's trying to convince the other person to trust him. So he exaggerates, or he says these far-fetched statements, not intending to pay them, never intending to pay them, but just simply to win the trust of the other party. And again there, that'll be a problem of asmachta lo kanya. So the Balei HaTosafot have categories on the extremes. Meaning where you lack total control, or you have full control, there's no asmachta. Because either you control the situations, and therefore you were gomer bedat to do it, because you knew you were in control, or you have zero control, and therefore you were gomer bedat, and there's no asmachta. The case is in the middle, where either you don't have full control, you only have somewhat of the control over the outcome, or in situations where you're exaggerating, those are problems of asmachta. So now the Gemara says, Ella. So then what's the problem in our Mishnah? If it's not an asmachta, what's the problem in our Mishnah? The fish ain't asukim bishuvo shalolam. That this person is not engaged in productive, constructive activity. My benayu, what's the nafkamina between them? Yigbenayu, the gamar umanata achrite. But he has a different profession. He has the ability to make parnosa through a different profession. This isn't his only means for acquiring parnosa. Or maybe you would even have to say, this isn't his means at all of making parnosa. It's simply for entertainment or for fun that he does this. And now the Gemara says, ditznan. Our Mishnah supports that understanding of Rishashit. Am Rav Yehuda, ematai. When is this true? Zman she'en lehem umanut elohu. That's in a case where he has no other profession. Aval yesh lehem umanut shlohu. If he has another profession, kshirim. There is no problem over here. Alma taimi dematnita mishum yishuvo shalolamu. You see that the reason in our Mishnah is exactly what Rav Sheshit says. It has to do with Yeshuvo Shalom. Kashal Rami Bar Chama. That's a strong question against Rabbi Bar Chama, who seems to indicate that the problem in the Mishnah is a smachta lokanya and not yishuvo shalom. Chitema pligi rabbanan leit Rabbi Yehuda. We just explained Rabbi Yehuda in the Mishnah, who says that the Tanakama, the Chachamim, agreed to Rabbi Yehuda's statement. Bahama Rabbi Yehuda ben Levi, koma kom shema Rabbi Yehuda. Anytime Rabbi Yehuda says in the Mishnah, eimatai ubameh, einu ela lefaresh divrei Chachamim. He's not coming to disagree, but rather to explicate or explain the position of the Chachamim. And our Mishnah says, eimatai. So you see that Rabbi Yehuda in our Mishnah is coming to explain the position of the Chachamim, not disagree with the Chachamim. And that means whatever Rabbi Yehuda says is equally applicable to the position of the Chachamim. V'yokun amar eimatai lefaresh. When you use eimatai, that is coming to explicate or explain the previous position in the Mishnah. Ubameh lachlok. When he says bameh dvarim amurim, that is a statement of chalukah, where he's disagreeing with the previous position. Udukuli alma, but both between Rabbi Yehuda ben Levi and Rabbi Yochanan, eimatai lefareshu. When he uses the terminology of eimatai, he's explaining the previous position. So that means in our Mishnah, Rabbi Yehuda is explaining the position of the Chachamim, and he doesn't disagree, or the Chachamim don't disagree with the reasoning behind Rabbi Yehuda. When it says, gavra, gavra, karamit? You're asking from Rabbi Yehuda ben Levi on Rabbi Bar Chama, that doesn't make any sense. Mar sabar plige, or mar sabar lo plige. I mean, Rabbi Bar Chama thinks the Chachamim disagree with Rabbi Yehuda. Umar Sava and Rabbi Yochanan and Rabbi Shua ben Levi think Chachamim bigrei velo plige, and they don't argue. V'hatanya, we have a braita that seemingly explicitly says that Rabbi Yehuda and Chachamim disagree. Ben she'esh lo umanut shalohu, ben she'ein lo umanut elohu. Whether he has another profession or whether he has no other profession, or is a pasul, then he is disqualified. That has to be the position of the Chachamim. Rabbi Yehuda doesn't agree with that. Rabbi Yehuda thinks that if you have an alternate parnosa or profession, then Rabbi Yehuda says it's not a problem. So clearly this is the position of the Chachamim being brought in a braita, and you see the Chachamim disagree and say that your profession makes no difference. So that would be supportive of Rami Bar Chama's view that they do argue. And how can you say here that Rabbi Yehuda doesn't argue? Where it says, no, that braita is not authored by Rabbi Yehuda. Habi Rabbi Yehuda mishum Rabbi Tarfoni. That's Rabbi Yehuda quoting the position of Rabbi Tarfon. The Tanya, we have a bright, Rabbi Yehuda Omer Mishum Rabbi Tarfon, Olam Ein Achad Mehem Nazir. None of them are classified as a Nazir. The feature on it, not Nizirut, Ela Haflaa. Because Nizirut has to be explicit and clear, not Bisafek. The situation, the circumstance they're speaking about, is when there's an individual that's walking towards them. And then there are two parties that are saying there, either they're saying that he is a Nazir, or he's not a Nazir, or they're saying that is so-and-so, and the other guy's saying it's not so-and-so. So then one of them says, if that's so-and-so, I'm a Nazir. And the other guy says, if that's not so-and-so, I am a Nazir. Then the guy shows up, and it is so-and-so, or it's not so-and-so. There, Rabbi Yehuda says the name of Rabbi Tarfon, neither of them are considered to be Nazirim. The reason is because you need Hafla'a. Hafla'a means clear and explicit articulation of becoming a Nazir. And so over here you lack that, because when you took the Neder Nazirut, you weren't sure if you were going to become a Nazir. There was still something that needed to be clarified afterwards. And you see here that whenever there's a safek involved, a person does not enter themselves and have gemira tadat when there's a safek. And that's what Rashi says over here. Alma the Rabbi Tarfon, chitalit na'a b'mide delab b'yodei. You see from Rabbi Tarfon, when you place a condition that is not in your control, below yadola, and you have no idea what the outcome will be, afilo achi avi asmachta. He considers an asmachta. Below amrina misfeka gomar v'akne. And we don't say that misafek, you go ahead and you conclude and make yourself into a nazir, a full-fledged nazir. Or in our case, that you would have an asmachta to agree to the outcome in the mistachek bekubia because it's a game of chance and you have no idea what the outcome is. So therefore you go merumakta. Rabbi Tarfon says that's not the case. Now, that is somewhat problematic because it's clear there that the reason why he's not a nazir is because by nazir it says, ki yafli. That the word yafli is specifically stated there, and the definition of yafli is to clearly articulate and have a known outcome in a situation, which means that you're taking a neder zirut that will be explicit. So then why are we extrapolating from that to our case over here? So the Balei Tosfot explain that that can't be the reason, because the word hafla'a does not have a fixed definition. We don't know what the word hafla'a means. We don't know what it means to articulate or to say something clearly. How clearly does it need to be? I mean, according to those that think that asmachta kanya, or those that think that in the case of a game of chance, that a person's gomer amakne, then that would be classified as hafla'a in that case, because for them, that gets a gemira tadat. So what the Balei Tosfot say is that the word hafla'a is defined by what you think is Gmira Tadat. And so it's not that we have Hafla'ah, and that's what defines by Nazir what you need to do, but rather, we know that the word Hafla'ah exists, we know we need a certain amount of certainty in Gmira Tadat. The question is, what is Gmira Tadat? And the fact that over there, where you leave something up to chance, something where you have zero control over it, and you have no knowledge of what the outcome will be, in those situations, you see that Rabbi Tarfon says, no go. So the fact that he says no go shows you that he believes that by those types of situations, there's no Gmira Tadat. And that will then define what Hafla'ah is. And that's why he says Hafla'ah rejects that type of Nizirut. And that's how Tosafot reconciles or deals with that situation. Now, as far as gambling is concerned, the Rishonim, in general over here, paskin like Rabbi Yehuda. And that is that Rabbi Yehuda says that our Mishnah is not a problem of Asmach Dolokanya, but rather a problem of our Mishnah is Bipnei Yishuvo Shelolam. The problem of the person's not Osei in constructive, productive activity, and therefore he's disqualified from being a aid in these situations. The question is, even if he is Osuk in another profession, does that mean that the person is completely kasher? Or is there some residual by which we say that the person is disqualified? And that the Rambam seems to say along those lines, which is, he passes like Rabbi Yehuda and says that the problem here is Yishuvo Shel Olam. The Rambam in other places seems to indicate that a person who is Osek in these things, even if he has Umanut Acheret, nevertheless, there's a problem because he's engaged in activity which is, quote-unquote, Gezel Midrabanan, or is activity that is not something that we would look favorably upon, or the type of activity or engagement is not something that makes you sensitive to others, that is a good way to come about taking money from others. And therefore, maybe there's a disqualification that is not only because Kenu Asuk Bo Yishuvo Olam, but Gezel Midivrehem, the way the Rambam phrases it is, Af Pishu Ratzona Balim Lakach, Hoi Ova Lakach Mamon Chavero Bechinam, Zerech Skok Vatel, or is it Gezel? That is classified like Gezel. So the Rambam over here seems to indicate that there is an overarching problem, independent of Yishuvo Shel Olam, which is that this type of behavior, this type of activity, is problematically inherently, and it speaks to a person who is not sensitive, a person who is engaged in somewhat coming of Gezel. Maybe it's not real Gezel, but it's Gezel Midivrehem, or even if it's not Gezel, it's involved in activities that are taking other people's money through smoke and a tell, and not through hard work and earnings. Shulchan Aruch brings down the psak of the Rambam. He says, "V'chein ha'misek v'kubia, v'hu shlo t'ye lo umanut elohu, ho v'ein osuk v'yishuv olam, ari ze b'cheska sh'ochel min ha'kubia shu avak gezel." So that's a quote to the Rambam that the issue is Yishuvo Shel Olam. And so then he brings this idea that engaging in this type of activity, even when there's no problem of Ein Osek Yishuvo Shel Olam, that there is a separate or additional issue of being involved in activities that are not productive. And then he brings the alternate opinion, which is Chalku Alav Lomar. People disagree. She'enu Pasulim Kein Lo Emunot Acheret. And there are many that disagree with the Tur and the Rambam, who say that the only problem is when he has no other profession besides this. The Rama over there says, Haga, that if he has another profession, even if he's playing with Jews, it's not a problem. He says the minhag already has become well entrenched, that people play these types of games, games of chance, games of gambling, and it's not classified as being problematic, or it's not classified as being gezel or disqualifying the individual. It may not be the best activity to engage in, but still, we're not going to disqualify an individual from engaging in that type of activity. There's more to say about this in terms of gambling and the different positions that are taken. So it's interesting that the Revad Yosef in the Shut Yabi Omer discusses the issue of buying lottery tickets in the Mifal HaPayis in Israel, whether one is permitted to do such. And so he quotes the Balei Tosafot, who we quoted earlier, who think that the Shor Lasachek Bekubia, playing games of chance, are permissible because there's no asmachta involved in there. But he says, despite that, Maran HaShulchan Aruch paskins like the Rambam, and therefore he thinks that according to the Rambam, according to the Shulchan Aruch and the Tur, that this is a problem of asmachta, and asmachta lo kanya. He says only the Rama, who quotes afterwards, who says that the svara is kesvara achrona, and Peshat HaMinhag that it's not a problem. According to the Ramad, Yesh Makom Latir, because he passes like Rav Sheshet, that it's not an Asmachta, and therefore it is permitted, although he does quote the Rivash, who says that everybody agrees, even Rav Sheshet agrees that Misachek Bekubya is an Isur, even though he thinks that there's no Asmachta Rav Sheshet, he still thinks that it's a Dabar Mechuar, Mituav, Mishukatz, Rabim Chalalim, Ipil, Batsumim, Kol Harugav. And he takes very, very negative statements about this type of engagement to or activity. And then he quotes also from the Shut Rav Palim, who makes a distinction between whether a person is entering into a lottery to win a particular object versus winning a pile of money. So if a person puts in money into buying or bidding or a lottery to win an object, then in that case, when he collects the object isn't what was you bought by the money that was put in by the other parties. So here, say, a Bala Bait says, I'm going to auction off in a goral this utensil. So everybody puts in a dollar, and whoever wins gets to keep the utensil. So the person who takes the utensil didn't take the money from the people who put in their money. So he doesn't have a problem with Asmachta Lokanya. Whereas if he took the money off the table, then it might have been a problem with Asmachta Lokanya. So there, the Shud Rav Palim distinguishes between what you take out, if you're taking a chefetz, an object that's independent of the money that's been put in, or you're actually taking the cash that's being put in, which is that you're taking more money than you put in. And he makes such a distinction to suggest that it's only problematic when you're taking cash out. When you take a chefetz out, it's not a problem. And then he goes on to describe that maybe even for the person selling the chefetz, it's not a problem. But that distinction does not exist when you're playing the lottery. When you put in money to play the lottery, you put in a dollar or you put in a shekel, and you expect to get out multiples of that amount of money. And therefore the Ravad Yosef says that maskona nedina, you may not participate in the lotto, you may not play in the Mifal HaPayis in Eretz Yisrael, says that even for Ashkenazim, it would be a good idea not to participate, yesh makom lesor lehem, even though technically the Ramah does permit such activity. The Rav Yosef takes a very strong stance based on that, to say that one may not participate in the lottery because of this problem of Asmachta Lokanya. So it turns out, the halacha, it's a machloket, we do paskin like Rabbi Yehuda, that there's an issue of Yishuvot Shel Olam, that's why one is disqualified in Misachek Bekubya, but then there's a question amongst the Rishonim as to whether Asmachta Lokanya has application here anyway. And that's the Rambam and the Tor seem to indicate it's really a stira in the Rambam. But in order to reconcile that stira, you would have to say that the Rambam believes that Asmachta Lokanya is an additional problem, or is also a problem over here, despite the fact that we think that Rabbi Yehuda believes that some of the issue here is Yishuvo Shel Olam. And that means that even in situations where you have an alternate profession, there may still be problems of either Asmachta Lokanya, or problems of engaging in activities that are not productive in nature, and therefore that could disqualify the individual, or it can be deemed to be a sur that you can't take the winnings from such an engagement. Whereas the Ramah seems to indicate that the minog, in situations where you have alternate parnosa, we do not disqualify the individual or we do not think it's problematic. But there is heavy evidence to the contrary that many Rishonim and Achronim believe that engaging in such activity is problematic and does not lead to good things. And therefore, we would dissuade people from engaging in such activities. Okay, we're going to stop here by the two dots on the top of Chofei Yomadal.